environmental history beyond the walls of academia.
But I do see certainly the need for environmental history research, not only to reach beyond the academy, but indeed to form partnerships to connect more deeply with the publics that, who, after all, are the people who are affected by environmental change or environmental interactions.
A conversation about environmental history as public history. I'm Sean Courage, and you're listening to episode 26 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. Environmental historians have recently been thinking about the future of their subdiscipline. Last year, the Rachel Carson Center for Environment and Society co-sponsored a workshop held in Washington, D.C. to explore such future directions. Canadian environmental historians gathered in Burlington, Ontario last spring to ponder similar matters. At both meetings, participants discussed the many roles that environmental history plays outside of the academic community. It seems clear that environmental historians want their research to reach broader public audiences. On this month's episode of the podcast, we consider the role of environmental history outside of academia as public history. To explore this topic and some of its challenges for the field, I spoke with a group of environmental historians with experience working in public history settings.
So my name is Karen Routledge, and I'm a historian for Parks Canada in Calgary.
And I'm Lyle Dick, and I'm the West Coast historian with Parks Canada in Vancouver.
I'm Lisa Maghetto. I'm the director of the American Society for Environmental History, which is a nonprofit scholarly group.
Well, I want to thank the three of you for joining us for this discussion about environmental history and public history. And I just want to start by giving listeners a sense of your backgrounds and how your work intersects in these two areas. So, Karen, could you start us off? What's your background? How does your work connect environmental history and public history?
Well, I've only been working for Parks Canada for about a year and a half now. Before that, I was a PhD student at Rutgers University in New Jersey, where I studied encounters between Inuit and Americans in the 19th century, so basically Eastern Arctic history. And when I was hired to work at Parks Canada, I work at a place called the Western and Northern Service Center, where we basically work with parks and national historic sites and marine conservation areas in the west and north of Canada. So since I started here, I've been doing a lot of work in northern Canada.
And Lyle, where does your work meet with this, with these areas?
Well, I've been a historian with Parks Canada for more than 34 years. And in that time, I've carried out quite a few projects that relate to environmental history on the Canadian prairies and in the high Arctic. Those included studies of settlement and the relationship between human settlement during the Dominion Lands branch expansion across Western Canada, and also the period of contact between Europeans and Aboriginal people, the Inuit in the high Arctic, and the impact of the environment on those groups and the interactions between them. The last 10 years, I've been involved with a couple of species at risk projects that involved extensive historical research. So that included the sea otter on Haida Gwaii and in the area of Guayanas National Marine Conservation Area, and also the Piri caribou, now listed as an endangered species in the high Arctic. So even though the focus of those projects was the animals and their status, of course, inevitably it brings in people, the people who hunted them, and the people who purchased the furs and so on. So those are some of the projects.
And Lisa, can you give listeners a bit of a sense of your background?
I got my PhD in history from the University of Washington, where I specialized in environmental history and especially fisheries issues. Before becoming director of the ASEH, I worked for more than a decade as the director of the History Division and the vice president of Historical Research Associates, which is a public history company that has offices in Seattle, Missoula, Portland, and other places. And there I helped develop an environmental history program and an oral history program.
Now, Lisa, in 2004, you co-edited a special issue of The Public Historian that dealt with environmental history as public history. Could you start us off by giving your sense of how that relationship between environmental history and public history has changed since 2004, or what the state of it is by 2011?
Well, now, what is it? It's 6 years later. The issues that environmental historians research have become even more serious. Climate change questions, for instance, and the importance of making or increasing public awareness has changed or has increased since that time. And also on a practical level, the need to look for outside the academy for sources of funding for environmental historians has increased since that time as well. So I don't know that it's changed so much as it's just become even more important.
Lyle, do you find the same thing?
I'm not as connected to the situation in universities, but I do see certainly the need for environmental history research, not only to reach beyond the academy, but indeed to form partnerships to connect more deeply with the publics who, after all, are the people who are affected by environmental change or environmental interactions. And so I think that is the main challenge. And, Sean, you were at the EH Plus, Environmental mm-hmm. History Plus, forum in Burlington, Ontario last May, and I think that was one of the key messages that came through in that discussion, which is quite rich, which was the need for us to really develop those kinds of connections in a significant way with the public historians, university-based environmental historians, but also constituencies with the people who are engaged in trying to enhance or sustain the environment.
Now, Karen, in your work, are you finding that there is a demand from publics outside of academia for the kind of research that environmental historians do?
Certainly. Since I started at Parks, I've been working on quite a few visitor centers, and certainly we're incorporating environmental history there, and people are very interested. One of the things that is really striking about working for Parks is how connected people are to place and how much they want to learn about those places. And usually when the public comes to a visitor center, they want to know about the place and how it's changed over time. So yes, in that sense, for sure.
So for the whole group then, what can public history offer environmental historians, or how can it shape or add to environmental history research?
I think public historians are often well connected with local communities, with environmental constituencies, the people we encounter in the course of our projects. We're quite engaged in trying to reach the public through public presentations or displays. Mm-hmm. Or in some cases, film. And, of course, there's people in universities who are using the medium of film to reach the public in a significant way, such as Ron Rudin from Concordia University. Mm-hmm. But I think we do have that kind of connection, and that will be a benefit to environmental historians in the academy, and that's why I think these partnerships could be quite timely, because we can bring the knowledge of those constituencies, those kinds of networks, together with the knowledge that's being developed in universities, and hopefully that can result in greater reach for these research projects.
Go ahead, Karen.
just to echo what Lyle said, I think that environmental historians are actually better than most other historians I know at crossing disciplinary boundaries, but as a daily part of my job at Parks Canada, I work with ecologists and Aboriginal communities and archaeologists and park staff who have spent their adult lives on the land in a single park or site, and that's the kind of connections that were harder to make in academia. So I think as public historians, we can bring in other perspectives and testimonies that aren't always seen in academic literature.
And Lisa, you wanted to get in?
Yes, I think that one of the definitions of public history is history that's done outside the academy. And in many ways, it's much more of a way of looking at a topic than a separate field of study.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that environmental history is especially well suited for going beyond the audience of the academy, just because we do look at issues that are of interest to the public, of current interest.
So what do you, as a group here, think that environmental history researchers could do to better integrate their work from the academy into public history or to reach audiences outside of the academy?
I think it would be beneficial for researchers, some are already doing it, but for more researchers, to connect directly with communities, to go beyond written testimony and textual documents, to work with histories, to develop oral histories with communities, to develop relationships with people who are involved in environmental projects or who are impacted by environmental projects. And I think there's a need to be proactive about that. Of course, there's many controversial and significant environmental projects which are underway at the moment, and Aboriginal communities and other local constituencies are very concerned about the possible impacts of those projects on their lives and on their communities, on their health. I think there's a real need for environmental history researchers to connect with those people, to hear their stories, and to help their testimony shape the questions which are asked and the kinds of ways in which it might be presented.
And this is Lisa. I would like to echo what Lyle just said by pointing out that, again saying that environmental historians can be proactive in this process, that they can ask themselves about their own research. Is there a government agency involved in the topic? Is there litigation surrounding this issue? If so, are there public meetings that they could go to, public hearings, public talks? I think Karen mentioned something about, or maybe it was Lyle, about going beyond the written history. How can those stories that are so important for getting people to connect with place be explored with the public or an audience beyond just the academic?
Mm-hmm.
And again, being proactive about that, then contacting those agencies and offering to talk to them about your research and about an exchange of ideas and what would be the most appropriate forum.
Yes, indeed.
I've seen that happen quite a bit in the Seattle area, and sometimes it even results in funding for the environmental historian, which we can get to later, the practical nuts and bolts.
Right.
Yes, and I think these kinds of connections can only build greater understanding, awareness of the public of environmental history research, and hopefully support for it. And, of course, support is key to the future funding of these projects.
So this is almost expressions of assertion of relevance on the part of environmental historians.
Well, I think that relevance is an important concept here, because people need historic context to understand the world, and especially to understand environmental issues. And environmental historians can provide that essential context and provide those stories that help us gain perspective and understanding.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. And my experience has actually been quite positive in my short time at Parks Canada. I mean, the entire reason why I work here is because when I was a grad student, I kept encountering parks historians and encountering their work, and Since I started here, there's been several examples where I've worked closely with academics. I mean, we often work on quite tight deadlines, and there's just no way that I'm going to be the expert in something that an academic's been working on for, 15 years. So, and in one case so far, that's led to one of the historians that I've been working with now applying for a SHRC partnership development grant to expand on research with Parks. And also, just before I arrived at Parks, I think Lisa Piper and Zach at University of Alberta brought a bunch of students down to Banff National Park on a field trip and met with the other Parks historian here, Meg Stanley, which from what I heard was a great experience for everybody. So, and also historians who write on certain topics have also offered to give lectures at National Historic Sites and things like that. So I think there is actually quite a bit being done already in terms of Parks Canada and academic collaboration.
It's interesting, too, thinking about this, that environmental historians might also consider the ways in which changing or rethinking methodologies might make their research connect to broader audiences. I think of Joy Parr's book, Sensing Changes, that both uses an online interactive web component to correspond with the book, but also the methodology of the book itself, dealing with lived experiences and sensory history, might connect this kind of research to audiences outside of academia a little bit better. But I wanted to get a sense from your experiences, what are some of the challenges that environmental historians might face in terms of conveying stories of human nature or relations in a public history setting?
Well, this is Lisa. I can think of three of them right away. And one is sometimes it's difficult to identify which public you're addressing.
Right.
The public is not a single-minded, unified force. Also, understanding that people bring a different context or framework if they're not from an academic audience to the material being presented. And lastly, this is a big one in environmental history consulting, and that is there's a perceived risk of influence in identifying with the audience too closely or letting them ask or influence the questions that are being asked.
So these would be instances of commissioned work as an environmental consultant?
Yeah, well, they could be, or just interacting with the public.
I think we also have to understand that we're becoming a very visual culture. We're surrounded by images. That's what people respond to. That's what people expect. I think historians need to pay more attention to images. I've given more than 30 public presentations over the last 10 years. Almost all of them are PowerPoints with full-frame images, both archival and contemporary shots, and people really respond to that. And when you connect the images to the stories, so that people really can insert themselves into these stories and really see the places, the environments you're talking about, they do respond often very strongly to these kinds of presentations. I think we need to look at how we're presenting to the public and how we're connecting with them. And I agree with Lisa. The public is really composed of many different publics, and we have to understand our constituencies better in order to connect with them.
Yeah, I completely agree with Lisa and Lyle. But when I first read when I first heard the question, I immediately thought of some advantages that we have. I mean, people, at least in parks, people who come to our parks and national historic sites, they're already in the place, and so they're already there because they're interested. And we have access to all kinds of media and tactile experiences that most academic historians don't have. I mean, when you're talking about the importance of salmon in a place, you can have like food programs, people can taste the salmon, and it's a very different kind of experience than my experience lecturing in a remote area from where I'm talking about. But I think, well, one of the challenges for parks in particular is that sometimes I get asked, why am I a historian for parks? People don't think that parks have a history, and especially an environmental history. They tend to think that they're quite unchanged over time. And So it is a challenge to get people to look not just at the material culture that might be around them, but at the actual landscape and how that's changed over time.
And it sounds like environmental historians or historical geographers have a kind of advantage in terms of thinking about the significance of place or physical experiences in place.
Mm-hmm.
So when thinking then about environmental history researchers today, what kind of topics in environmental history do you think are the most relevant or best suited for reaching different kinds of publics outside of academia?
Well, just speaking of the Species at Risk projects that I've been involved with, especially when you're dealing with iconic mammal species, people really seem to respond to them, such as the sea otter or the Piri caribou. These offer an opportunity to reach to talk not only about the these particular animals and their status, but the environments, the habitats, the ecosystems in which they operate, and their interactions with other with other organisms and with humans. And that's one way of just, yes, indeed, with the sea otters, people have warm and fuzzy feelings about them. And one of the biggest, the greatest number of hits of any environmental video that has been posted on the web in recent years is the Vancouver Aquarium's posting of the two sea otters holding paws as they're swimming on their backs.
Right.
And, of course, this is a very cute image. In fact, the sea otters hold paws. It's part of rafting behavior. That's how they stabilize themselves in the ocean when they're confronting wave action. So it really has very little to do with anthropomorphized notions of nature. But it is a way of drawing people in, and then you can develop the story more deeply. But once you have once you've got them on the hook, you can reel them in. So I think that's one way of connecting with people.
Lisa, where do you see urgency in terms of the kind of research environmental historians do and the necessity to have that research move outside of academia?
Well, we mentioned climate change earlier. You mean the types of topics? I think land use histories, any kind of natural resource use histories could be made useful. I think that actually just about any topic in environmental history could be made interesting and could be useful to a public outside the academy. The researcher just needs to ask the question, who has a stake in this research? Right, what's the larger significance, and how do I reach that community? And I think that, well, going back to the methods of presentation, that would be an important consideration as well.
Karen, in what ways is climate history being incorporated into public history presentations with Parks Canada?
I'm not sure I can really speak to that right now, but
Okay.
In my studies of the High Arctic for Kootenai Bark National Park of Canada, I looked at the climatic history of the Arctic and its importance as a shaping force and in human history and human animal interactions and what have you. So climate is certainly an important part of the story, you know, in the long term, the long durée of climatic history, its cycles, its oscillations. It's really key to understanding human history, especially of such sensitive environments as the High Arctic, which are very much influenced by even slight changes in the environment and climate.
Right. So I wanted to circle back to something Lisa brought up earlier about funding and environmental history research. In what ways could there be benefits for environmental historians engaging with the public in terms of access to funding?
Well, I think SHRC SHRC, our major Canadian funding agency for historians, is increasingly interested in partnerships. So certainly engaging with public organizations and federal organizations is is an important component of applying for those grants now. So.
Well, this is Lisa. There are, in addition to government agency funding, which could come in the form of grants or proposals, the word proactive was mentioned earlier, and I think that if environmental historians are interested in not only making their work more visible, but also making it more lucrative outside the university, they could be more proactive. For example, often environmental litigation involves historical questions.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be lucrative work, that is, providing research for attorneys. That doesn't mean that the environmental historian is an advocate mm-hmm. of one position or another, and it doesn't mean that the research changes. The research methods are the same. The investigation, synthesis, analysis, good writing, that's important no matter what area of public history an environmental historian enters.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody's going to be answering those historical questions, and it might as well be somebody trained in environmental history doing that. That can be lucrative, and it also can get, well, not so much in terms of exposure, but there also, it's in the Seattle area, for instance, there are regulations that require biologists to study endangered species, and they're doing the work of historians.
Hmm.
Well, I've seen instances where once they realize that the historian can, there might be historians out there already doing it or could do the work more efficiently and sometimes less expensively, they can be hired to augment the research that's being done by foresters, by biologists.
Yeah, and I think those are very good ideas. And now in Canada, I believe that environmental impact legislation is somewhat constraining, or at least maybe the regulations develop further to the legislation in the sense that often it's archaeologists who are brought in to assess the impact of major projects. But clearly there's a need for environmental historians to be deeply engaged in the assessing the impacts of environmental projects and oral histories with communities potentially affected by these projects would certainly be very desirable. And if it's not required by the legislation or the regulations, it seems to me that environmental historians would be well served to push for this to be interpreted as a key component, because it's just a more holistic way of assessing the impact of these environmental projects.
And I've seen environmental historians, this is Lisa, work with archaeologists on projects to provide information that maybe the archaeologists couldn't do so well, like to establish historic habitat conditions or early population distributions. I mean, that's something that a fisheries historian could provide.
For sure.
But part of this is being proactive and going out there and meeting with the archaeologists and the government agency personnel mm-hmm. that are working on this to get your research out there.
So just to close things off and bring us full circle, I want to ask the group to go around and just give us a sense from your own experiences of some of the benefits that you've seen or experienced with environmental history reaching different publics.
Well, I've had the great pleasure to be engaged in several high Arctic projects, and in particular the Piri Caribou, which I mentioned, and that brought me into contact with mm-hmm. the High Arctic Hunters and Trappers organizations, Inuit hunters. And an opportunity, it was fantastic to hear about the traditional knowledge they have developed, the ways they go about hunting and sustaining their communities, how it connects to the seasonal cycle, their interactions with the environment. And it's a very inspiring story, and I've done my best to try to bring those stories to Canadians in the South so they can better understand and appreciate the
the incredible role the Inuit have played in high Arctic survival and adaptation. And it's a way of sensitizing people to issues which are on the table right now, but they may not be able to connect with it as directly. And when you can show them images of Inuit hunters, the Hunters and Trappers organizations, the environment that they operate in, then I think people, it's like Eureka, they get it somehow. So I think that does offer a lot of opportunity, and I would love to be able to do more of that. I hope more environmental historians will have that chance to better connect their awareness, their understanding of local communities and environments with the wider public.
And Karen, what's been your experience thus far as a newcomer to Parks Canada?
Yeah, most of the projects I've been working on are still in process, so it's harder to comment on what impact they'll have. But certainly, for me, I've been really impressed by the infrastructure and partnership agreements that Parks Canada has. So it's been incredibly productive for me working with local Métis groups, First Nations groups, Inuit groups on these projects, and talking to park staff about what's important in their park, what people want to hear about there. So hopefully it seems like the project I've been working on, it's going to be a good way to combine the work from academics that I draw on with local concerns.
And Lisa, what have you found?
I found that the fact that environmental history is already interdisciplinary means that most environmental historians are used to working in teams, or they're receptive to the idea, which allows them to do all kinds of things, ranging from public hearings to, writing op-ed pieces, to assisting biologists in writing reports on habitat conditions, to talking about mining and energy policy in public hearings. I think that, as I said earlier, environmental history is well-suited for working with others and exchanging ideas with others.
Well, this certainly seems to be quite an engaging topic for environmental historians. As Lyle brought up, we had this meeting in Burlington where engagement with different publics was one of the central points of discussion, and I'm sure this won't be the end of that discussion. I want to thank the three of you. Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Lisa. And thank you, Lyle, for sharing some of your thoughts on environmental history as public history.
Thank you, Sean.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Lyle Dick, Lisa Maghetto, Karen Rutledge, and me, Sean Courage. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes page at niche-canada.org/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, and leave comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast, and don't forget to rate this podcast and write a short review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/naturespast. If you have any ideas for new episodes or you want to send me some feedback, you can contact me through my website at seancourage.com. You can always get the latest information on events in the environmental history community from the Niche website at niche-canada.org. And you can find out more about the topics we discussed on this episode on our show notes page. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back in January with another episode of Nature's Past.